Hello, and welcome to a Science Set free podcast with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Hi, Rupert.
Hello, Mark.
You've just handed me a copy of your new book. Thank you very much indeed. And the Science of Spiritual Practice. And I wondered if we could talk about that.
Yes.
I'd be really interested to know something about, you know, what's in the book, what you discovered through researching the book. I'm aware that you've spent the last maybe even couple of years really researching quite hard into these subjects. What was it that particularly drew you to thinking about the way that science and spiritual practice relate?
I suppose it's partly because there's been so much research now on spiritual practices that starting with meditation, that's the one that I think has had the most research, and it's the one that from the 1970s onwards has been the most widely propagated as a form of spiritual practice that doesn't have to be done within the context of religion. So I think what's interesting is that these practices that have grown up in all religious traditions, I mean, they all have versions of meditation, all have versions of pilgrimage, another practice I discuss, all have versions of rituals, all have versions of singing and chanting, all have versions of relating to nature. All of these, and all have versions of gratitude. These are the practices I discuss. They've been embedded within different religions in their own forms, but this rather secular way of thinking about them that came about through scientific study of meditation first has provided a way of looking at the practices, what they do, how they affect people, studying their effects scientifically, both on people's lives, well-being, happiness, and things like insomnia, depression, etc., and also on physiology. So meditation, for example, has obvious physiological effects. It reduces blood pressure. It gives people a better relation to the rest of their lives. They sleep better, are less depressed. So these advantages, and together with physiological studies of changes in brain activity, give a greater insight into what's happening during these practices. They make them more credible because they show this is not just something you have to take on faith. These have scientifically proven benefits. And these studies show that all these practices have great benefits for those who do them. So we're in a new situation, and for many people who don't follow a religion and therefore don't do these practices as part of a religion, it opens up this new possibility of doing these practices even if you're not part of a religious tradition.
One of the things which I was looking at recently, actually, was research on meditation. And as you're saying, it seems very well established that it has these therapeutic, well-being kind of benefits, which, you know, intuitively makes sense. You actually only have to sort of sit still yourself to feel that you're entering a slightly different zone and that things come up and that you can pay attention to that, or you feel more in your body, that kind of thing. But one of the areas which I was looking at particularly was how meditation has been studied in the Christian context as opposed to in a Buddhist context, because Buddhists and those affected by Buddhism have really made the running in this with the development of mindfulness-based stress reduction and so on. And I wonder whether, you know, you looked at that as well. So, for example, there was a study done, I read, of people that had been on an Ignatian retreat, an eight-day retreat, you know, where they did a contemplation which they focused on biblical stories, that kind of meditation, rather than, say, a meditation focused on the breath or using noise as a kind of a rest, a returning point. Have you teased out some of these differences?
No. I'd be very interested to know what you found.
Well, I think it was very early, but they were suggesting that, first of all, that the Christian meditative practices can have the same effect, even though they ostensibly come from quite a different tradition. But also, the next wave of research will have to look at, beyond the sort of baseline, it's good for you, whether, for example, interpreting your meditative experience in, say, a theistic context, as opposed to, a less theistic context, at least, has a difference as well. They're saying that the science can't show that yet, but intuitively you would wonder whether there would be some differences like that.
Well, this is, of course, a very interesting question, and we did have discussed this a bit before in our talk on meditation, but it's one of the things I discuss in my chapter, because now there are leading atheists like Susan Blackmore and Sam Harris who are publicly advocating meditation and who practice it themselves. What they're trying to do is show that meditation can be done in an atheist framework, where you're not presupposing that you're contacting any greater consciousness than your own. And a lot of people who do mindfulness meditation may not question, you know, what's this relation to a bigger picture. It's just you get these benefits from doing it and you feel better and here's the practice. A lot of people may not reflect very much on it. But traditionally, it's had a huge impact on the way people see the world. And the very basis of Hindu philosophy is the idea that Atman, the consciousness within each of us, is part of Brahman, the great ultimate consciousness of the universe, that our consciousness is a kind of fractal version of this greater consciousness. And it's not a separate thing. It is the same consciousness. And one can actually directly experience that link or connection or identity through the practice of meditation. But for people who don't have the idea that there's a greater consciousness beyond our own, whether it's called Brahman or God or Nirvana, which is defined rather negatively in terms of what it's not, those who think it's just inside their brain presumably interpret it very differently, and it has a different effect on their lives. I haven't seen any research on that so far.
I wonder whether, maybe your own feeling as much as anything else, but whether divorcing the practice from the spiritual framework, what impact that has, what implications that has. And again, just this is more personal from me, but I have been involved with an organisation called the Mindfulness Association, which comes out of a Buddhist tradition. And they actually have a sort of 3-year program of developing the capacity to meditate. And I was drawn to it because I quite like this idea that it was several years of practice. But at the end of it, at the end of the 3 years, this question of the bigger framework within which you were going to understand, you know, a more developed practice now, really came to the fore. It's not something you would have particularly anticipated to start with, but as it were, maybe, you know, once you develop some capacity to tolerate your own ups and downs and your own wandering mind and so on, the sort of what next question really did arise, actually. And it was quite a challenge for me personally, because I feel strongly theistic, whereas certainly a more Western Buddhism is more ambivalent about that. And then you can look at other Indian philosophers as well, which, you know, perhaps sort of somewhere in between. But I wonder whether in your own, you know, thinking about this as much as the science, do you think this question does come up, that the metaphysics, as it were, comes back in spite of the fact that it can be studied without that?
Well, it does. And, I mean, it's a really a big issue, because in this book I'm talking about 7 different spiritual practices, all of which can be done outside a religious framework. You can just do them. And they sort of, what I do in the book is leave the question open. I myself, because I'm a practicing Christian, do all these practices myself within a framework. But you don't have to be within a religious framework to do any of these practices. And it's a unique historical situation we're in at the moment, because I don't think there's ever been a time in history before when most people in the population have said they have no religion, when they're not working within a religious tradition. I mean, in Western Europe, this is now a fairly standard situation. I don't think it's ever been the case in any period of human history. So there are a lot of people who are starting from not having a religion, who can do any of these spiritual practices. And for some, they can meditate for years without feeling a need to become part of any religious framework. And some people in the secular Buddhist movement actively oppose the idea of a religious framework. They want the Buddhist practice, but they don't want the Buddhist stories or a framework or belief in reincarnation or rebirth or anything like that. It seems to me quite possible that anyone who practices these particular practices may find themselves being drawn back towards a religious framework. Some of them, like pilgrimage, for example, which is one of the practices in the book that I discuss, connect to holy places, and those holy places usually do have a religious framework. If you go to India and you go to the temples, then clearly they have a Hindu framework. If you go to Sufi shrines in India, they clearly have a Sufi and Muslim framework. If you go to cathedrals in England or great holy places of Ireland like Croagh-Patrick or Loch Derg, then those have a Christian tradition. So although many people who go on pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela and other places are not religious, they are connecting with a religious tradition. So it's not clear whether doing these things in a not religious framework is a temporary phase through which people pass on the way towards a more comprehensive framework, or whether it's a long-term situation where spirituality can be sort of unbundled from religion and exist as a whole series of options without people feeling the need to put them into a religious framework.
One of the ways I've heard about handling that is to think about how religious traditions have an exoteric element and an esoteric element. Mm. So the idea is that, for example, if you go on pilgrimage, you might go on pilgrimage to Westminster Abbey, and you will go to the shrine of Edward the Confessor, who, in terms of the exoteric element, is an English saint adopted by royalty, you know, part almost of a sort of medieval theocracy, you might say. Mm. So very quite clear exoteric side. But if you kneel inside the shrine, having made the journey to get there, perhaps having listened to some beautiful music on the way, taken part in the journey with others, there's something happens that you experience that, in a way, the exoteric element is just a sort of container or a holding framework for something that's going on that's much more implicit, and the power of the place, your own particular situation at the time, opening up onto something that's bigger than yourself. That's really kind of what matters.
Mm.
And I guess that you can have that experience if you went to a Hindu place, a pilgrimage, as you say, or if you went to, you know, there's some other religions, maybe even, you know, going to indigenous tribal sites, and that sense of opening up would be experienced as well. I mean, does that resonate?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I lived in India for 7 years, as you know, and I went on pilgrimage to quite a few Hindu temples and holy places. And some of them I found immensely powerful and you know, had very powerful experiences in them, a sense of connection. And that made me feel a connection with the land of India, the traditions of India, and the spiritual traditions of India. I don't see those as incompatible with the rest of my spiritual journey, but they're definitely linked into that tradition.
Do you think that part of what these spiritual practices are doing for people is, in a way, the very fundamental task of just opening up to more than material reality, the sense that there is a kind of implicit, dynamic, energetic, perhaps, side to reality, as well as the empirical, the measurable, that which is much more obvious to the scientific mindset? Do you think that you know, that's part of their appeal and part of their work at the moment?
Well, when I was thinking about these practices in my book, Science and Spiritual Practices, I was trying to think, as I wrote the book, with these seven different practices, what they have in common. What makes pilgrimage, meditation, connecting with nature, singing and chanting, doing rituals, spiritual practices, and what is it that unites them in a sense, though, because they're very different activities. In pilgrimage, you're walking through the countryside towards a sacred destination, meditation, you're sitting quietly with your eyes closed. I mean, they're not obviously similar. I think the common factor that I could see in all of them is connection. They all give you a sense of connection to something bigger than yourself. Meditation to a dimension of the consciousness, which is bigger than our normal waking consciousness, where we're concerned with our intentions, thoughts, worries, fears, desires, and so on. A connection to the ground of consciousness itself. Pilgrimage or connecting to a holy place that is a bridge between heaven and earth. Most holy places have this characteristic of connecting the heaven and the earth, the sky and the soil, as it were. The connecting with nature is about feeling part of the greater process of life and earth and the solar system, the cosmos, connecting with the physical, the natural world in which we live and which sustains us more consciously. And connecting with plants is one of the other things I talk about, and how through relating to flowers and trees, and through flowers we're connected to a realm of beauty which is pervasive in the world, through trees to organisms older and bigger than ourselves. All of these practices are connections. Singing and chanting, if we sing with other people, we're connected with the people we're singing with and with all those who've sung the same kind of song before. Rituals, we're connected with a whole tradition in which that ritual has been practiced. So all of them are about this sense of connection. And not doing them, the opposite of this, is a sense of separation or isolation. And I think that the secular world, on the whole, has a very isolating effect on people, because it breaks down traditional connections, which are provided by traditional religions and family bonds and all the usual things that traditional societies have, producing something that's much more based on an idea of atomized individualism, disconnection. It means we're freer from social bonds and restraints, but it means we have much less of this connection with the natural world or with each other.
And I think that that sense of connection, maybe it's easy to underestimate the difference that can make. Put it like this. My sense would be, from what you say, that awakening to that dimension in life, to the way that things are linked, isn't just a sort of nice to have, and with a few therapeutic benefits on the side, but it really can open up your mind to different ways of thinking about yourself, the spiritual life, but also reality itself. You know, one of the things which I've noticed in debates, say, about science and religion, or between theists and atheists, these kind of culture wars, is that a practice can actually take these discussions into a completely different dimension, that, say, purely rational discussion or empirical evidence-based discussion really can't. You get sort of locked into a particular frame, and, you know, there's certain things that can be said and discussed, but it stays locked in. So, you know, these practices and this connection we're talking about, it actually has very substantial ramifications, would be my sort of sense of things.
I think so, yes. I think they have many ramifications, and I think that this sense of greater connection does open up, well, through the very sense of connection itself, the feeling that we're part of something bigger than ourselves, and part of something bigger than ourselves in human terms, as part of a society, as part of the changing evolution of humanity, part of the natural world, part of a conscious world which is far greater than us. I mean, all these things come about through these practices. And this sense of connection does have measurable health benefits on the whole. It makes people happier, healthier, live longer, and so on. I mean, these are all measurable benefits. But these measurable benefits don't give you the actual inner feeling of that comes through this. And I think that the way this develops, we don't yet know, because it's the idea of spirituality outside a religious context is quite a new one. I mean, I think it was pioneered by the meditation movement in the 1970s. And then people like my wife, Jill Peirce, who've been teaching chanting and singing in a way that cuts across all different traditions. Again, since the 70s or 80s, there have been people pioneering ways of teaching spiritual practices that do it in a way that doesn't require a prior commitment to a religious tradition. But it's a relatively new phase of human activity that we're in, and no one knows where it's going to go. And it's only really become very widespread, I would think, in the last 5 or 10 years.
It makes me think of the early Christian period in a strange sort of way. I was recently looking at a new exhibit of the London Mithraeum, which was discovered originally in the 50s, but has, with new building in the City of London, has been put in a new fantastic display, actually. It was really tremendous. And what they've really tried to do there is set off the remains as an experience, not just as archaeological artefacts, you know, using lighting and sound and chanting. So you can go into the subterranean site, subterranean now, and, you know, perhaps catch a glimpse or an echo of what was going on in the first and second centuries AD. And I think, too, you get the sense that it was quite an experimental time. There was still a lot of beliefs around, in the sense of, you know, belief in gods and so on. It was different from our time in that respect. But there was a keen quest for an individual take on this, you know, which a mystery religion, you know, like Mithraism, and I think like early Christianity, too. The mystery there just means that it was designed to, through rituals and rites of passage, to give you a direct sense of things, not just what we told things. And maybe, you know, where we're at now parallels that to some degree. And who knows, as you say, quite what will emerge, you know, 100, 200 years down the line.
Yes, I think the key thing now is that all these practices are based on experience, and that most people don't particularly want teachings, doctrines. I mean, the whole world is saturated with information, and schools are full of filling people up with facts, and exams are all about writing them down, learning stuff and passing exams. That what they leave out, what the whole educational system leaves out, except in areas like physical education and sports, is experience. And all religions and spiritual traditions really start from experience. So I think it's really that rediscovery of the experiences on which these things are based that's going on at the moment. Another big area we haven't talked about today and don't have time to do is psychedelics. And I would say that a lot of the psychedelic experiences that are happening today are kind of explorations of consciousness, which, and why it's appealing to people, is that it starts from, not from theory, but from experience. And that's the most direct sort of, take this pill and, you know, in half an hour you're going to be having a mind-altering experience. That's the most immediate of them all, in a way. So I think it's a starting from experience, building up from experience, that's going on now. And I think that's what was happening, as you say, with Mithraism. Also with early Christianity, when people were baptized, a rite of passage, which, as we discussed before, may have involved a near-death experience. This was starting from something that had a powerful personal effect and led to a change in worldview. But the experience came first.
In researching and writing the book, what is the thing that you discovered that was, you know, most surprising or new, or you hadn't realised had developed to such a degree, or, you know, what was it? What's a standout kind of headline from the book for us?
Well, I'm not sure that there was one. I think it was really not a single one. I mean, what it was a realisation there are these many different practices. I mean, I only discuss 7 in this book. There's many other spiritual practices that I don't discuss in this book that I plan to discuss in a subsequent book. But that there are so many ways that one can gain this sense of connection, and that some appeal more to some people than others. I mean, plants, for example, are very important for me. I've studied botany. Plants have been a big part of my life. Flowers, trees, and other aspects of plants. For some people, they're not very important. You know, pilgrimage is an important thing for me. I like the actual physical journey. for some people, they don't particularly want to go on walking through the countryside and muddy fields and things. So there's such a range of ways of connecting that are open to us, and we can find ways that work for us. I mean, that was really perhaps not very dramatic conclusion from this, that there are so many doors that we can open, so many ways of connecting that can enrich our lives and open up our spiritual development. And the other thing is that practically all of them are free. You can do any of these things. Meditation doesn't cost anything. Contemplating flowers or relating to trees doesn't cost anything. Going on a pilgrimage, you still got to pay for food and shoe leather and things, but it's basically not a very expensive thing to do. Singing and chanting with other people is free. It's really this sense of tremendous opportunity. And in the world we live in, where many people are closed into a world of social media, constant information overload, that there are all these windows one can open and let the fresh air in of some other kind of connection. The tremendous potential of all this is what struck me most.
And the science there to help you tease out what's within that potential, you might say, what that potential can mean to you.
Yes, the fact that these studies can be studied scientifically, and the fact they can be shown to have measurable beneficial effects, is very important in the modern world, because unless it has the stamp of approval of science, most people think it's not real. And since I'm very empirical in my own thinking, and I like doing experiments, is what I do a lot of the time, the fact that these experiences can also be studied experientially. Experience and experiment are very close. I mean, in France, it's the same word. Experience means experience and experiment. And science is empirical, and empirical means based on experience. So the fact that science and these experiences can converge, I think, strengthens them rather than weakens them. And also it gives science a positive role in all this. For many years, science has had a kind of negative role in religion and spirituality. It's been seen as something that ridicules or casts aside or rejects everything to do with spiritual and religious traditions. Here, in this context, it's a far more positive and constructive role.
And I know that each chapter ends with something you can try out yourself, some suggestions and so on. So it is very much a practical book, as well as a book that tries to pull all this scientific investigation together.
Very much so, yes. The whole point is that you can actually try it. And at the end of each chapter, I suggest two practices that are simple, don't take long, and are free, that anyone can do if they're interested.
Well, it's a very nice-looking book. It has a beautiful plant on the front. It has a nice weight and feel, so I'm very much looking forward to getting into it properly. Thank you.
Good. Thanks, Mark.